We're going to talk about the hip arthritis chapter from Orthopedia, the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine. You can find it online at www.orthopedia.com. It's edited by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayet.
It's a fantastic resource.
But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient,
definitely
don't rely on us. Read the book.
Good advice.
Today, we're diving deep into osteoarthritis of the hip.
Okay.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Sure.
To get us started, what's the basic setup of the hip joint that we're talking about?
The hip is like a classic ball and socket joint.
Okay.
You've got the acetabulum. That's the socket in your pelvis.
Gotcha.
And the head of your femur, which is the ball. And these two fit together, as you can see in figure one.
Okay.
The x-ray with the femur highlighted in red and the pelvis in purple.
Okay.
And that articulation allows for a really wide range of motion.
And what's responsible for making all that movement, like, nice and smooth?
That smooth, frictionless movement. It's courtesy of the articular cartilage, sometimes called hyaline cartilage.
Okay.
It's a layer covering both the acetabulum and the femoral head. It acts as a super shock absorber, cushioning the joint and allowing everything to just glide easily.
So we have the basic structure.
Yes.
Now, what are the main drivers behind hip osteoarthritis? What starts this process of wear and tear?
Well, the big one is simply age-related wear and tear. Over time, that repeated stress of using your hip can lead to a gradual breakdown of that articular cartilage.
That's probably not too surprising, but the chapter also mentions a connection with obesity.
Right.
How does that factor in? My initial thought is just the added weight.
That's a natural first thought. The mechanical overload of extra weight stressing the joint.
Yeah.
And that certainly plays a role. However, it's interesting to note that obesity is also linked to arthritis in non-weight-bearing joints.
Oh, okay.
Like the thumb, suggesting there might be more to it, perhaps involving things like inflammatory signals in the body.
Okay.
It's likely a combination of factors.
Interesting. The chapter also touched on a couple of other things that can contribute.
Yes, developmental dysplasia of the hip.
Okay.
And a history of slipped capital femoral epiphysis can increase someone's risk of developing hip osteoarthritis later on. But those are conditions that primarily affect children and are discussed in detail in another chapter.
Okay, so we'll stick to the adult picture for now.
Right.
What about injuries? Can a bad fall or something like that lead to this?
Absolutely. While not as common as age-related wear, a significant fracture, one that damages the hip joint directly,
okay,
can indeed lead to post-traumatic arthritis.
Right.
It's essentially arthritis that develops as a consequence of that initial injury.
And osteonecrosis got a brief mention as well.
Right. Osteonecrosis, also known as a vascular necrosis, is where the bone tissue dies due to a lack of blood supply.
Okay.
That can also be a cause of hip osteoarthritis. This can be triggered by trauma or certain medical conditions, but again, that's a more complex topic that's covered separately.
Uh-huh. So it sounds like while cartilage damage is a key part of it,
yeah,
it's not the only thing happening. Is that right?
Exactly. There's a common idea that osteoarthritis is just about the surface of the cartilage wearing away.
Right.
While that's where it often starts,
sure,
the process definitely extends to the underlying bone as well.
And the chapter describes some specific changes in the bone.
Yes.
What are those?
As that cartilage thins significantly, the underlying bone can start to rub against other bone.
Oh.
This repeated friction can lead to eburnation, where the bone takes on a smooth, polished appearance.
Okay.
We also see subchondral sclerosis, which is a thickening of the bone just beneath the cartilage.
Uh-huh.
The bone is essentially trying to reinforce itself in response to those abnormal stresses.
Interesting.
And finally, osteophytes, or bone spurs, can form at the edges of the joint as the bone tries to grow in irregular ways. Figure 2, the x-ray of hip osteoarthritis, clearly shows examples of joint space narrowing, subchondral sclerosis, osteophytes, and even a subchondral cyst.
Wow, okay, so we're getting a good picture of what's going on inside the hip.
Yeah.
Now, how does this actually manifest in a patient?
Right.
What are the typical symptoms they might experience?
Patients often report a combination of stiffness, pain, and a noticeable reduction in how much they can actively and passively move their hip.
Okay.
The pain is frequently described as this deep, dull ache. While it's most common in the groin,
yeah,
it's important to note that this pain can also radiate to the buttock, down the thigh, or even into the knee.
That radiating pain can definitely make diagnosis, like, a bit tricky, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
Are there any other specific things patients often mention?
A particularly telling symptom that many people with hip osteoarthritis experience is increasing difficulty and eventually the inability to reach down and tie their shoes.
Oh, wow.
It's a seemingly simple task.
Right.
But it highlights that loss of hip flexion.
That's a really practical and relatable example.
It is.
What might a doctor find during a physical examination?
On exam, we might see that the patient is overweight. They also might be walking with a limp. We'll often find limitations in their hip range of motion. And in more advanced cases, where the joint has really deteriorated, there might even be a noticeable shortening of the affected leg.
Let's dive a bit deeper into that limp.
Yeah.
The chapter described it as having a, like, rocking quality.
Right.
Similar to what's called a Trendelenburg gait.
Right.
Can you explain what's going on there?
Certainly. The gait in hip arthritis can resemble a Trendelenburg gait, which in classic terms involves a drop of the pelvis on the non-weight-bearing side due to weakness of the hip abductor muscles. However, in arthritis, it's not necessarily true muscle weakness causing this pattern. Instead, as the chapter puts it, these muscles become reluctant to work.
Reluctant to work? What does that mean in this context?
Well, because the action of the gluteus medius and minimus muscles involves putting force through the hip joint,
yep.
A patient with arthritis will often instinctively avoid using them fully to minimize pain.
Right.
So even though the muscles might technically be strong enough, the patient alters their walking pattern to reduce the demand on them.
Okay.
This results in that lurching or rocking motion over the affected hip, almost mimicking true weakness. This pain avoidance walking style is called an antalgic gait.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So how does using those gluteal muscles actually put force on the hip joint?
Think about when you're standing on just one leg.
Okay.
During walking, we're essentially doing this for a good portion of each step. Now, if you're standing on your right leg, your body's center of gravity wants to tilt your pelvis downwards on the opposite side, your left.
Okay.
To stop this tilting and keep your pelvis level, your right gluteus, medius, and minimus muscles have to work hard, generating a strong counterforce.
So it's all about maintaining balance.
Precisely. The total force that your hip joint experiences is the sum of your body weight trying to cause that tilt and the force generated by those abductor muscles trying to prevent it. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. If you can somehow reduce the amount of force those abductor muscles need to produce, you can reduce the overall stress on the hip joint.
And that's what the antalgic gait achieves.
Right.
How does that work?
Instead of striving for a perfectly level pelvis while standing on the affected leg, the patient will often lean their upper body towards the affected side.
Mm.
The subtle shift in weight distribution gives the unaffected leg more time to swing through and return to the ground, reducing the need for those painful abductor muscles on the affected side to fire as forcefully.
Okay.
It's a subconscious way of taking some of the load off the arthritic hip. Figure 3 in the chapter does a great job of illustrating the difference between normal standing and the antalgic gait.
That visual really helps to clarify the mechanics.
Yeah.
So when we're trying to diagnose hip arthritis, what role does imaging play?
Imaging is key to confirming the diagnosis. A weight-bearing anterior-posterior, or AP, view of the pelvis, along with a lateral view of the affected hip, are usually what we need.
And what specific things are we looking for on those x-rays?
Hip osteoarthritis is classified based on the severity of certain findings on the x-ray. We look at the degree of joint space narrowing.
Okay.
How much the space between the femoral head and the acetabulum has decreased compared to a healthy hip. We also look for the presence and extent of subchondral sclerosis, that bone thickening we talked about.
Right.
And the formation of osteophytes, those bone spurs around the joint.
Is it standard to image both hips, even if only one side is symptomatic?
Yes, it's common practice to get x-rays of both hips. Osteoarthritis frequently affects both sides.
Mm.
And having a comparison can be very helpful in assessing the extent of the disease.
That makes sense. But the chapter also mentions something about a mismatch between what we see on the x-ray and what the patient is feeling.
That's a crucial point. Not everyone who shows significant signs of hip arthritis on an x-ray will necessarily have severe hip pain.
Okay.
Conversely, although less common,
yeah.
Someone with severe hip pain, but minimal changes on imaging,
yeah.
Is less likely to have osteoarthritis,
yeah.
As the primary cause of their symptoms.
So the image is just one piece of the puzzle, and we need to consider the whole clinical picture.
Absolutely.
Now, what other conditions can sometimes look like hip osteoarthritis? What's on the differential diagnosis?
There are several conditions that can mimic the symptoms.
Okay.
Lumbar stenosis and degenerative disc disease in the lower back are important to consider.
Okay.
A general guideline is that back problems usually don't cause pain in the groin, and hip problems rarely cause pain above the belt line.
That's a helpful rule of thumb.
Yeah.
What about pain in the buttock area?
Buttock pain can be a bit tricky because it can originate from either the lower back or from the hip osteoarthritis itself. A thorough history and physical exam are key to telling the difference.
And what about pain on the outside of the hip?
Pain on the lateral aspect of the hip is more often due to issues outside the hip joint itself.
Okay.
Most commonly, greater trochanteric bursitis rather than osteoarthritis within the joint.
And in younger patients who might not have significant changes on their x-rays, yeah, are there other possibilities to consider?
In those cases, especially if they're experiencing hip pain with activity, mm-hmm, we might think about conditions like femoroacetabular impingement, mm-hmm, or FAI, or labral tears.
Okay.
These can cause pain and dysfunction even with minimal radiographic changes in the early stages.
Right.
But as noted, those are topics for another discussion.
Okay, so we've covered how we diagnose it. Mm. Now let's talk about how we manage hip osteoarthritis.
Okay.
What are the non-surgical treatment options?
Non-operative treatment is usually the first approach for most patients. Physical therapy plays a vital role in strengthening the muscles around the hip, particularly the abductors and extensors, as well as the core muscles. This can really help with pain management and improving overall function. Pain medications like over-the-counter and prescription NSAIDs and acetaminophen, Tylenol, can also be used to help manage the pain.
And we touched on it earlier when we were talking about the limp, but how exactly does using a cane help?
As we discussed with the antalgic gait, the goal is to reduce the forces going through the hip joint.
Right.
Using a cane in the hand opposite to the affected hip, that's contralateral, can significantly decrease these forces.
Okay.
Figure 5 in the chapter illustrates this.
Okay.
Think back to the analogy of holding onto the side rails of gym equipment. Even a small amount of support can make a huge difference in reducing the load your muscles have to handle.
Mm.
A cane works in a similar way, helping to stabilize your pelvis and reduce the stress on the arthritic hip.
That makes a lot of sense. What about the role of weight loss?
Weight loss is another really important non-operative strategy. Losing excess weight directly reduces the amount of force going through the hip joint.
Yeah.
Which can lead to less pain and potentially even slow down the progression of the disease. It's important to acknowledge, though, that achieving and maintaining significant weight loss can be a challenge for many people.
Absolutely. And what about injections? I believe cortisone injections into the hip were mentioned.
Yes. Cortisone injections can be given directly into the hip joint to help reduce inflammation and pain.
Okay.
However, because the hip joint is quite deep and surface anatomy isn't a reliable guide,
right,
these injections usually require the use of fluoroscopy.
Okay.
That's real-time x-ray imaging as shown in figure 6.
Okay.
Or ultrasound to ensure the medication is delivered accurately into the joint.
Okay, so those are the non-surgical options.
Yes.
When do doctors start considering surgery?
Surgery is generally considered when non-operative treatments are no longer providing enough relief from the pain and disability.
Okay.
And the patient's quality of life is significantly affected.
And the most common surgical procedure is a total hip arthroplasty, right?
That's correct. Total hip arthroplasty, often referred to as total hip replacement, is the most common and very effective surgical procedure for end-stage hip osteoarthritis. As you can see in Figure 7, which shows an x-ray and a diagram of the procedure.
Okay.
It involves replacing both the damaged acetabulum and the femoral head with artificial implants.
That sounds like a pretty major procedure. What are some of the things patients and doctors need to think about with that?
Well, it's a very successful surgery for relieving pain and restoring function. It's important to be aware that there's a small risk, around 1%, of significant complications during or shortly after the surgery. Additionally, those artificial components can wear out over time and may eventually require a second surgery called a revision in the long term.
Okay, we've covered a lot of really important information.
We have.
Let's finish up by reviewing those 5 key terms that the chapter highlighted.
Absolutely. These 5 terms really capture some of the core concepts we've discussed.
Okay.
First, hip osteoarthritis itself, the degenerative joint disease of the hip that's been our focus.
Right.
Second is subchondral sclerosis, that thickening of the bone beneath the cartilage that happens in response to the abnormal forces in an arthritic joint.
Okay.
Third, we have osteonecrosis, which we briefly mentioned as a potential cause.
Uh-huh.
And it refers to the death of bone tissue due to lack of blood supply.
Okay.
Fourth is the cane. an assistive device that, when used on the opposite side of the affected hip, can effectively reduce the load on the joint.
Yeah, okay.
And finally, total hip replacement.
Yeah.
The surgical procedure where the damaged acetabulum and femoral head are replaced with prosthetic components to treat advanced hip arthritis.
Those are definitely key concepts to keep in mind.
Absolutely.
And just as a reminder, this deep dive was based on the hip arthritis chapter from Orthopedia. That's the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. It's available online at www.orthopedia.com completely free of charge.
It's an amazing resource.
And one last time. Before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Go read the book. It's there for you.
Great advice.
All right. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you in the next deep dive.
See you then.